Second speaker tonight is Tom Eye.
I'm Tom Iverster, an alcoholic. I'm from Aberdeen, North Carolina. I hear some South Carolina people there. The home of Jim Valvano and other folk in black suits. It's great to be here. I'm a member of the Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern Pines, North Carolina. It's a group very similar to this one, and when I walked in tonight, I just felt right at home. It looks very much like my group. We read the same steps, same traditions, same orderly chaos, and it's great to be here. I've heard a great deal about this group, and it really is a privilege and a pleasure to be here. I've had occasion to meet many of your members who do missionary work around the country, and and I'd like to report to you that they do good work. You may wonder what they do when they're out in the colonies stamping on the grapes, and I'd like you to know that by and large they do good work. They carry a crisp and current message. Language is reasonable for California. Deportment is quite good. Most of them go to their rooms alone or with a conference-approved partner. And I've wanted to see the source, and so I'm delighted to be here, and it's good to see a bunch of old friends. The red light's going to come on shortly, so I won't have time to get into a whole bunch of frivolity. I'm going to have to just get right down to work. It's a strange group that this formidable hammer looks like the political convention has no effect whatsoever on this crowd. And a quiet shh is magic. It's just magic. It gives the muscular young man something to do with that. It really is a pleasure. I want to share with you as much as I can, and I won't have time to share it all and wouldn't anyway, but I want to share with you as much as I can my own story of my recovery from alcoholism. I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous February 2nd, 1957, and through the grace of God and the miracle of this program, in my life, I haven't had a drink since. And I think that's a thank you very much. I think that's an absolute miracle, and it's one I'm deeply grateful for. It's been 33 years of absolutely grand living. It's been an absolute adventure. The day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous started the greatest adventure that I could possibly imagine. And I want to share with you as much as I can about that adventure. I never am 100% sure how it's going to come out. I want to talk primarily tonight, I think, about those kinds of issues that have to do with grabbing hold of and hanging on to this thing called sobriety. And I want to talk a bit about the movement itself as we go along. And I never know exactly if it's going to work out that way, but that's what I have in mind. I really do believe it's a miracle that I've been here since my first meeting, that I've been sober since my first meeting, but I'm deeply grateful that that's been my experience. I'm deeply grateful that can be the experience of anybody who comes into this program. I think it's exactly the way it ought to work. You know, that if yours is a fairly short time in this program, I would encourage you to hang on to it dearly and don't let it go, because this program is designed to not fail. And if I give my broken and wasted life to it, it'll give me a brand new way to live. It'll give me an adventure in living. And so I encourage you to hang on, because the gift that's mine is the gift that can be anybody's. And so I want to share with you as much as I can about that. Yeah, I think if I had to identify the place from which my alcoholism came, I think I could do it. And it has nothing to do with drinking. If I had to go back and capture the place from whence it came, where to start? Had nothing to do with booze. It came about before I ever got seriously involved with booze. And I think it really had to do with my spiritual life. Now, George is an ardent fan from South Carolina. I was born in South Carolina, in the Bible Belt of the South. And my early introduction to a spiritual life was like many, many people in the South. For some, it takes. For some, it does not. And I was one for whom it did not. And I remember, and I believe my alcoholism came as a result of my development or lack of development in that area of my life. I remember as a little boy being introduced to the church of my parents. And I remember the innocent, childlike faith of going through the motions of practicing what they practiced simply because they practiced it. It had no meaning to me. I remember singing Jesus Loves Me and all that kind of thing. I remember even more clearly as a small boy when the seeds of doubt started to appear in my life. And I started to realize as a little kid that I didn't seem to believe what they seemed to believe. I didn't seem to feel what they seemed to feel. I didn't seem to have the kind of experience that they seemed to experience. And I remember the enormous fear associated with that as a small kid, to be rebelling at the thought of something as omnipotent as God, the great fear that something dastardly was going to happen to me very quickly. I remember the great guilt associated with that. I remember the feeling of frustration that grew over the years. And what set up in my life then, and I think laid the seedbed for my alcoholism, was the spiritual dilemma that I think is fundamental to this disease, and certainly to my case. It set up a deep-seated conflict. Now, conflict is a term that could be as complicated as you want it to be. A learned person could talk about it endlessly, about all the nuances of conflict. To me, it's a very simple notion. It's feeling one way on the inside and acting another way on the outside. And that explains a great deal about what happened to me as a youngster, where I started to feel one way on the inside, act another way on the outside, and started to have things in my life that I could not or would not share with other people. I started to live that dual of existence, of having feelings that I was afraid or unsure about sharing with other people. And I really believe that it laid the groundwork for this thing, because that deep-seated conflict spread into every other area of my life and I think impeded my development as a human being. It caused me to be a guy who was very much in distress with himself. And that tension and discomfort and uncertainty that existed there is what made me a sitting duck for this thing called alcohol. You know, conflict really is a simple thing. I've heard it described a lot of ways, like watching your mother drive off, your mother-in-law drive off a bridge in your Mercedes. That's conflict. I was beginning to think I was in the Black Forest. I never saw so many Mercedes in my life as there is at this synagogue. Somehow there seems to be a contradiction in terms. Well, anyway, it's a simple kind of notion. You're the guy who loves sex and hates women. For many people, that's a conflict. For some, it really isn't, but it's a conflict. Yeah, it's a collision of ideas, a competing of ideas. Let me tell you one other that I'm not sure if it has anything to do with conflict or not, but let me tell you this anyway. I just like the story. I want to hear it one more time. And these two fellas, cannibals, were paddling down a river, father and son. And the father was teaching the son to hunt. And you know what cannibals hunt. So they're paddling along, and the son sees a beautiful young lady trotting along the riverbank, and he says, "Hey, Dad, I see one." And his dad looked and said, "You sure do." And he said, "Dad, let's go over there and catch her and take her home and cook her." And his dad said, "Son, you catching on. We will go over there and we will catch her. And we will take her home. But we're going to cook your mama." I'm not sure if it has anything to do with conflict or not. It probably would in my house anyway. But I think that was the seedbed. You know, the foundation, that foundation for alcoholism to grow was that thing of a lad divided against himself. And all of that distress and turmoil was just absolutely ready-made, so that when booze came along, it was tremendously important to me. It did great things for me, and it was magic. Yeah, there's a guy in this group who talks about the experience of that first drink when it hits and goes boom, and how true it is. I'm always interested in listening to non-alcoholics attempt to describe their first drinking experience. They barely know what year it was or what they drank. I think it was whiskey or wine. Am I close enough? Or wine or whatever. But it's a sort of a blah experience. But listen to the average alcoholic. We not only know what year, we know what time of day, who we were with, what... Oh, geez. It's a technicolor experience for us. Yeah. And certainly that was my experience. And that's no mystery to me about why alcohol was important to me immediately. It's no important to me why I went... It's no mystery to me about why I went back. It's no mystery to me why I continued to, because what I found in booze was the thing that gave me release and relief from all the problems of my life. And I found in alcohol the greatest friend I ever had in my life. I never once went to alcohol and didn't find exactly what I needed. Now, in the latter days, I found a great deal more than I wanted. But I found always what I needed. I would have been stupid not to drink. And I had basically two phases of drinking. One was, I can only exaggerate problem drinking. I drank too much, got drunk, got fights, got my nose broke, went to jail, lost job, wrecked cars, woke up in strange places, strange people. I don't really believe I was an alcoholic. I drank like one, I acted like one, but I wasn't really one. I think I was one in the making. Now, I think there are three basic elements to alcoholism. One is the spiritual dilemma that I described. I think that really was the seedbed for this one. I think the other is the mental thing, the mental obsession, the unmanageable life. I think there's something about my mind that causes it to react differently to alcohol if I drink, and to react differently to it if I don't drink. There's something about my mind that causes it periodically to turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink. I don't understand it. I just observe it, and I know it to be true. Now, I think that characteristic was probably in place. I started serious drinking when I was about 16 years old, drank too much, got drunk, all the things happened. I think I probably had some of the compulsive traits, the personality makeup, all that kind of stuff. Don't really believe I was a fully developed alcoholic. It happened with me when I was about 18 years old. Didn't realize it then. It was only when I looked back that I recognized that along in my 18th year is where I made that important move that separated me from every other drinker in the world except other alcoholics. I crossed a line, and something happened to me physiologically so that I was to never be able to take another drink without the phenomenon of craving occurring and without my behavior being unpredictable on the one hand but highly predictable on the other. And I was to never be the same. If I took one drink of anything with alcohol in it, I got drunk. Mattered not what it was. Tried everything from VO to Vitalis hair tonic. It all did the same thing. I even tried hydraulic brake fluid one time. I didn't mean to. It was some enterprising drunk sold it to me for... Well, anyway. It worked, I guarantee you that. My God, it locked me up to something fierce. And even that, I can't even drink brake fluid. There was something happened to me in my 18th year physiologically so that I would never be the same. I became an alcoholic. I developed the disease alcoholism. And I'm one who believes that it's a disease. I believe from that point forward, my choices were slim to none. On the one hand, I could drink. God knows I could drink. But I could not drink without disaster. I could not drink without absolute loss of control. And the only other choice I had was to get to a point that I understood and committed myself to living the rest of my life and never taking another drink. Now, I had no earthly idea that was so. I had no earthly idea my drinking had changed, that I had become alcoholic until well after I was in recovery. But from that day to this day, my life truly was never the same. And I honestly believe if I took a drink in California tonight, the odds are that I would not get back to North Carolina. The odds are that my lovely wife, who's never seen me drunk, would see all she wanted very quickly. And I think I would be exactly where I left off, only 33 years worse. I fully believe that. I haven't experienced it, but I've seen it in the tragic example of many of my fellows. Who on earth am I to think my case would be any different? I will never be the same in that sense. Mine is an irreversible condition. It will not change. It only gets worse. And I believe that. That's the disease of alcoholism. That's what happened to me when I was 18. My story from that point forward was like every other alcoholic I've ever heard. The events might have been a little different. The consequences might have been a little different in terms of physical difficulties that I got into, but the story was tragically the same. It's an interesting thing to me. When I first came into the program, I was here for almost 2 years before I ever heard one single alcoholic with whom I identified. I mean one. And now I rarely hear one with whom I don't identify. I think they're making a better grade of drunk these days or something. I don't know what it is. No, I do know what it is. When I came in, I understood alcoholism to be the physical evidence, the trouble I got into out there. And then over time, I came to understand that the real dilemma of alcoholism is the trouble that I got into in here. Alcoholism, in its ugliest form, is an inside job. And there's little difference of whether we fall apart and wind up physically on Skid Row or wind up losing it and going to Skid Row in a penthouse or a mansion on a hill. There is absolutely no difference. None whatsoever. And mine was like every other alcoholic. It was that innumerable kind of attempts to get going. And I think if I had to characterize my life, it was essentially a seemingly endless series of failures and new starts. Failures and new starts. And it seemed like every time I failed and started over, settled for a little less and a little less and a little less, until finally, in the relatively short period of 8 years, I wound up going from a fairly average-looking freaky kid to a fellow who at age 24 had reached a point that I was living on the street, living in a method and means that I never imagined I could have lived. I could not have imagined. And I didn't get there overnight. You know, I got there a failure and a new start. And every time I failed, started over a little less. So that those things that at one time would have been unthinkable for me became very normal. I came from a poor but a very decent family. I wasn't raised to drink wine out of a jug with a bunch of strange characters in alleys, but that's where my kind went, and that's where I went. I wasn't born to that. I wasn't born to get soup in the soup kitchens. I wasn't born to sleep in a movie theater, park cars, or that sort of thing, but that's where my kind went. I wasn't born or reared to hustle drinks on the street and roll folks and stuff like that. I wasn't born to that kind of thing, but it became very normal for me. I wasn't born to sell my life's blood at $5 a throw, but that's what my kind did to survive. And I achieved that in you know, we seem to come in two basic forms. One is the kind who goes through a long career of drinking and gradually loses it. And there are some, like I and some of the others I heard you earlier, that is a more quick and episodic kind. And that's what mine was. Mine was a very quick and episodic thing. And that's what happened to me in a short period of 8 years. Reached a point that I was unemployed, darn near unemployable. And the last few years that I drank, I used to say that I'd live by my wits. But that's not exactly true. I live by my total lack of character. I don't know of one thing, not one thing that a man can do that I haven't done. Not one. And I'm not proud of that by any stretch of the imagination. But I pray to my God that I never get so arrogant in my sobriety that I forget it or that I'm unwilling to share it. I need to understand what alcoholism does for this guy. I believe that I would have drunk myself to death. Don't have any question that I would have... never could keep up with my drinks. I believe that I would have drunk myself to death if I had just been left to find my way here. I don't think I would have ever done it. Have no way of knowing that. But it wasn't to be my experience anyway. I drank myself into that condition, and I wish to God I could tell you that one day I just had enough and threw in the towel, called for help, and found a brand new way to live, but that's just not the way it happened. I wound up doing, before I got here, the kind of thing that I know every person in this room who has either been alcoholic or lived with alcoholic has lived in dread that it might happen. I know that. I've never met an alcoholic who hadn't had the rather chronic fear that they might in a drunken blackout or drunken mess wind up doing irreconcilable damage to other people. Thank God for most, it's a bad dream and it doesn't happen. But I'm here to tell you that for some, it's a very real nightmare, and I was one of those. Woke up in jail one morning, Flint, Michigan, city I was living in. Jail I'd been in many, many times. Knew everybody that worked there. And I assumed when I woke up in there, it was for the same thing as always. Either drunk or fighting or stealing or whatever. And I took it for granted it was the same thing. Now, after a little while, a jailer came by, a guy I knew well, asked him when I could get out, and he said, "I hope never," and walked off. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I knew he wasn't kidding. And then some of the other guys in there told me that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of that city and had run down and killed two people. And my reaction was just like yours or any human being's would be. Just shock and disbelief. I could not believe that such a thing could happen. I've come to understand a little bit about the mind. It protects itself. You know, it only accepts what it can handle. And my response was just basically to push it away and pretend it wasn't so. And then gradually accept the fact that indeed I had done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. And it was a matter then of, you know, how do you pick up the pieces? How do you balance the scales between a street drunk and two fine young people with their lives in front? Well, obviously you don't. Only time I'd ever been in jail, I didn't want out. I was afraid to get out. Didn't tell anybody who I was, where I was from. They found out and then contacted my folks down in North Carolina. And my mother made what was to be her last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy out. Wasn't her first one by any means, but it was to be her last one. She died 4 years ago, last Thanksgiving. And I truly believe of the many prayers of Thanksgiving that I have in this program, top of the list is the fact that when that dear lady died, it was with gratitude for a program that had given her a son for 29 years instead of a drunken embarrassment as it had been for too many. If I never got another thing out of this program than that, it would be worth everything I've ever done 10 times over. And so she came to negotiate my release. I was charged with manslaughter, and I really didn't know how to tell her I didn't want out. Got an attorney, got me released on bond. I'd been in there 76 days. I knew that I wouldn't drink. I didn't tell anybody that. I just knew that I didn't. I thought the guilt was so great I could not have picked up a drink. I just didn't understand the nature of this disease. Got out, stayed sober a day and a half, and then between July and November of 1956, I drank like nobody I have ever seen. And I don't mean that in any weird macho kind of thing. I was a pathetic case, no question about that. There was no mystery then nor now that I was trying to drink myself to death. That was clear and obvious to any observer. And it clearly did not happen. And then November the 19th was actually the date of my last drink. At least what I hoped for was my last drink. Didn't know it would be at the time. Finished off a little piece of a bottle of gin and went to court. I knew it was going to be the last one for a while, because I knew it wasn't coming back. And that day, I had no defense. I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me. And I was naturally found guilty. And sentenced that day to a max of 15 years in a state prison in Southern Michigan. I'd been in jail all of my life. I'd been in jail so many times I couldn't even imagine how many. Still can't. But going to a penitentiary was a different thing. And my reaction that day was much as anybody's would be. An instinctive reaction of fear, because I had no illusions about it. I knew where I was going. An instinctive reaction of fear, but almost simultaneously the most real sense of relief I'd ever known. because I knew it was done. I knew it was over. And the next day I walked into Jackson Prison in Jackson, Michigan, the largest walled institution in the world. And I honestly believe, except for one or two of your noble institutions, it is the worst one that I know of in the world. The day I walked in there were 6,000 human beings of some description in there. Some very fine guys in there. And some of the sorriest excuses for human beings I've ever seen in my life. A liberal sprinkling of both. And the day I walked into there, I never believed I would ever come out of there alive. And I, honest to God, didn't care. I hope to God I never forget that young man, nor have any illusions about who he was and the shape he was in. I was a mighty sick young fella. Didn't realize how much so until I started to get well. And somehow or other, in that strange, weird land, that was to be the land of beginning again for me. It's really interesting to me. I guess if I could look at it, interesting is the wrong word about your own life, but if I could look at it, it really is interesting to me that I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk in my life. And there was a little social worker talked with me one day, told me about AA and pointed a direction for me, and I've never looked back. I responded to the first invitation I ever heard. Now, I didn't respond eagerly, because I can't say that I was a joyful convert. I never had been looking for a way to stop drinking. I don't know about you, but I never particularly wanted to stop drinking. You know, I always thought that sober people were the most boring specimens available. I never wanted to be sober. I didn't want to be drunk either. I wanted to be on that marvelous plateau about midway between the two conditions. Now, I didn't really had no particular interest in being sober. And I think the only reason I went to AA was that I didn't have any fight left. I just absolutely had no fight left. And so I walked into my first meeting. It was a meeting about a fourth the size of this. My home group, the recovery group at Jackson Prison. It'll always be my bedrock home group, I guess. But I don't want to attend meetings there for darn sure. But it'll always be my home group. It had 300 guys in it, and the day I walked in, started that great adventure. Now, I'll assure you, it did not feel like an adventure that day. I was not an instant convert. I'm glad of that. I'm not a real fan of instant converts. I think instant converts make very rapid failures, you know. So I like to see slow, agonizing growth in this program. It tends to last. I ain't fond of putting folks on the circuit after 30 days. Forget it. I'm not as bad as some Gestapo-type sponsors that you may have heard of in other groups. But as a general rule, when I sponsor somebody, they don't get up and say nothing until they got 9 months. If they talk real easy, it's a year. Yeah, so I believe in taking that thing in perspective and letting it grow slowly. Now, I wasn't a real happy camper when I walked into that first meeting. I didn't know what to expect. It wouldn't have mattered. Whatever I had expected, it would not have been like what I saw. And I sat down and listened to the first meeting I'd ever heard, very similar to this one. And I listened to a speaker that day, and I listened to an alcoholic tell his story. I'd never heard anything like that. And I'd heard alcoholics tell stories, but I'd never heard one tell his story. And I could not imagine that. If somebody had asked me after the meeting, what have you just done? I would have probably said, I've listened to a madman rant on. I could not imagine why anybody would waste their time hanging around a penitentiary, airing their dirty laundry like that fellow was doing. It made no sense to me. I was a long ways from the brother's keeper philosophy. A long ways from that. You don't get too steeped in that on the street. It helps me to help you. Yes, sir. I'll let you have the pleasure, sir. Yeah, you got a long ways from that. And so I really didn't know. I thought many times about what it was that brought me back. Now, what was it that clicked with a guy that was so burdened with guilt, so burdened with ignorance about the condition, so burdened with hopelessness, so burdened with resistance to change, so totally unworthy? What was it that made the difference with a guy like that, so that
that here, over 33 years later, he can say it was a turning point in his life. Well, I really don't know all of it. I tell you this, the first 8 months in this program were as miserable as any period I ever put in my life. I went to meetings, listened to speakers, but it was their speakers. Participated in discussions, with their discussions. Read the books, it was their books. But when I look at what made the difference with me, I go back to that guy who spoke at that first meeting. You know, his name was George Shy Walker. He's been dead now for many years. He became my first sponsor, and I loved him better than Peter loved the Lord. I never identified with him in terms of his experience. He wasn't even my kind of guy, really, except that I loved him dearly because he was a true giant in this program and one of the most enthusiastic people I ever met in my entire life. He was the kind of guy that when he told his story, no matter when he told it, he told it with such dynamic quality that it just lit up a room. And I think that's the one thing that brought me back, was that giant of a man. What a great fellow he was. You know, when I think about our heritage, about our program, I can understand, in a way, about those fellows who were in the early days, Bill and Dr. Bob and Bill and Eddie and those early guys who started putting it together. I can kind of understand them. How they were just a bunch of drunks, didn't know what they were doing, just sort of doing it. And then in the early 40s, remember what happened, we may not remember what happened, but look at what happened in our history. Up to 39, they only had 100 folk. Only 100. My God, you got more of that on the coffee detail here. 100 folk. And then, you know, you could see what was happening with those pioneers hanging together. And then in 41, a series of things started to happen, not the least of which was that Jack Alexander article. And all at once, there was a tremendous growth in this program as alcoholics all around the world started to respond to the news that there was an answer at last. And who answered the calls for help? There were a few people. And I'll guarantee you, you'll find it in the history of AA in L.A. There were a few people who rose to the occasion. And in those early 40s and 50s, watch what happened as a program came together. As people did Herculean things to put this thing in place all around. And these weren't guys who had divisions. These were folks that just sort of had a hope. And I think there were some real giants who emerged during that period in our history. Tremendously important people to me. Those were the people that carried the message to me. That group of people who came in. And I think they were a special group of people who carried that message in a very special kind of way. The last of the people who personally carried the message to me died in February. The last of them, a fellow by the name of Pete Slager up in the state of Michigan. Great fellow. The last of them died. And I can't help but wonder when I think about the passing of Pete and the passing of giants in your lives. What does this connote for us? You know, there was an old country singer. I know you guys don't listen to country music in L.A., but just in case you happen to hear it by accident, a while back there was a country singer by the name of George Jones who put out a song called Who's Gonna Fill Their Shoes? Who's Gonna Fill Their Shoes? And he was talking about the legends, the giants of country music, and who's gonna come along to do that. But I would suggest to you that the same idea applies to us. Who's gonna fill their shoes? Or do their shoes get filled? True giants in this program who stuck to it and saw it through. I was listening to the early history of this group. This group didn't start out 1,200 strong. You believe that? It started out with a few guys with a dream, a few guys with some commitment, and they went through some long and lonely times. laying the groundwork so that a group could grow. Who's going to fill their shoes? Yeah, I wish that I were, and I'm not a prophet of gloom by any stretch of the imagination, but I wish I were more optimistic than I am. Now, it is thrilling to me to come in here and see a massive crowd like this. That's thrilling to me. But unfortunately, I travel too much to let this thrill last me very long. This is a pocket of absolute thrilling evidence of the program being alive. But let me share with you that these pockets are not all that frequent. And as I travel around, I see vast areas where these pockets do not exist. And I wish I were more concerned. You know, I'm more optimistic. I am concerned. I'm concerned when half the groups in our country don't even have GSRs or don't even know what they are. I'm concerned when I sit in a meeting of 20 people and only two of them even know what traditions are, other than something to recite at a meeting. I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned when half the groups in the country don't even donate to our own World Service office. I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the drastic decline in sponsorship. I'm concerned about the active outreach. I don't know what you do in L.A., but in many areas of this country, things like public information or cooperative relationships with other agencies are almost non-existent. Yes, I'm concerned about many things. I'm concerned about meetings that get so big that you can't find anybody in them. Now, this is a marvelous thing, but I hope that all of you have places where you have intimacy in a meeting, too, because you could get awfully lost in this group, couldn't you? You get awfully lost. I'm concerned about many things in the program. I wish I were more optimistic. There are some giants in our history. There are some giants in our picture today. There are some presenting questions about what will happen. You know, one of the things that I see that causes me a little bit of concern is that we probably are taking in more people in Alcoholics Anonymous today than ever in our history. There's no question that that's so. But I would submit to you that we're watching just about as many go out. What we're seeing is an enormous revolving door, and I'm concerned about that. There's plenty to be concerned about. One last one. I'm concerned about anonymity. And I know that you guys are on the cutting edge of that, and anonymity is a strange kind of point to understand. It's gotten to a point, and it's humorous in a way, and yet it's very frightening in a way, that we've almost seen Alcoholics Anonymous become a status symbol, so that it almost is something you would put on a resume, that I'm a member of Alcoholics. I understand in this town you can't hardly get a part in a movie without that. And there's great trouble in that. There's great trouble in that element of anonymity. I'm also concerned about the other extreme of anonymity. I'm a believer, like Dr. Bob said, that it is as much a violation of the principle of anonymity, not to break it on the one hand by egotistically disclosing, it's as much a violation to selfishly withhold when we can be of help. Let me share with you, I won't name the city, but there's a city not too far from here. It's not in this state. It's in Oklahoma, Van Oy. It's where there is a movement that has started, and it may serve great purpose, but it scares the fool out of this one. A movement called home groups, and I don't mean groups that folks belong to, like you belong to the Pacific group, and I belong to the Big Book group. But I'm talking about groups that meet secretively in homes, unannounced. And I'm given to understand that in that city, 75% of the members go to AA under those circumstances. And when I was told about that, I said, well, where do the folks go that don't get invited to those? Oh, they go downtown to the clubs. My next question was, well, who works with them? And they work with each other, blind leading the blind. I would submit to you that there's something deeply troubling when Alcoholics Anonymous moves into that kind of subterranean existence and moves away from active work with alcoholics. Starts thinking more about who comes to my meeting than who needs to be here. Who needs to be here? How do I reach that person who's not here? So anyway, lots of things that I'm concerned about. And when I think about who's going to fill their shoes, let me suggest to you, fellow alcoholics, that if they get filled at all, it's me and you. There ain't nobody else. There ain't nobody else. And what I see happening in the program now far too often, it's a movement into what I call me and my program. I don't know exactly where it comes from. I have my own suspicions, but it doesn't matter where it comes from. It just simply seems to exist. Where there is an inordinate focus on a constant process of checking my emotional pulse. You know, how am I doing today? And what am I feeling today? And rat's fanny. Jesus! That drives me nuts with this loosey-goosey junk. What I see is nothing more than a perpetuation of the same self-centered condition that got me in trouble to start with. If I can't get beyond checking my emotional pulse on a regular basis, I'll miss the whole thing. If I can't get beyond being nothing but a sponge that soaks up what I need and takes it home, I'll miss the whole thing. If I can't get beyond nothing more than a self-centered program and can't get to a point that I understand myself to be a chain in this chain that reaches, a link in this chain that reaches around the world, I'll miss the whole thing. What I've got to come to understand is my great need for other alcoholics. Not their need for me, but my great need for them. I have to understand that the group is bigger than the individual. The group is bigger than me. And I'm a part of the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not just the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not just the recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I am a mainstream member of the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it does, in fact, take more than two alcoholics sitting around talking to each other to be a part of this movement. Otherwise, I miss the adventure. The adventure is not from not drinking whiskey. Not drinking whiskey is not a new way of life. And it's not an adventure. The adventure comes from getting caught up in the movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's thrilling to me to see the Pacific group in this city. It's thrilling to me to see what's happening in the Soviet Union. And that wouldn't be thrilling if I weren't a part of the movement. And so what I think saved my life in this program is the fact that I met people here who reached out to me in that spirit of unquestioning, accepting love in a way that I couldn't deny. People who were like me, who weren't like me anymore, but who cared enough to share, cared enough to share. And I'll be ever grateful for those guys that carried that message to me and gave me that sense of being a part of the legacy. And this thing clicked for me in Jackson Prison. I won't have time to go into a lot of details. Let me tell you this. I think that this program works for any alcoholic who wants it to work. I don't care who you are, where you are, what your circumstances. It worked for me at a time in my life when I had absolutely nothing anybody could want but a broken and wasted life. It worked for me at a time in my life when I had absolutely nothing that most people think's important. I didn't even have a name. A fellow walked up to me a while ago and introduced himself as 35888. And I responded that I was 94153. And we identified ourselves as those numbers retired, with emphasis on retired. I joke about that today. That was no joke when that was my identity. That was no joke when somebody called me on a raucous horn and said, 94-153, report here, report there, do this. No. That's what I brought to this program. That's what I brought. That's when folks carried the message to me. Absolutely nothing that I could give. Absolutely nothing that anybody wanted. Yeah, I really believe that none of us, if I may be so bold, get and stay sober by accident. Now, I think we get sober by miracle, but I don't think we get sober by accident. I don't know of anybody that just got struck sober and found themselves happily in a new way of life. It takes some dues paid. And as a result, I tend to get a little bit hard-nosed about the thing. Let me tell you, and I'll have to close on this kind of hopefully sobering thought. When I look back, and I don't mean anything braggadocious in this, but when I look back to the 300 people at Jackson Prison that I went into AA with, there are two of us who are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous today. Two. Now, unless you think that's some starkly revealing story about prison groups, look back to your own origin, and you won't find it radically different. Two. There's one who's been sober since his first meeting, and you can figure out which one. In case you haven't already figured it out, let me tell you which one I would have voted for if it got put to a vote. This one right here. Now, I'm not one who gets overly generous about this thing called AA. A dear friend of mine said one time in a meeting, and I know it was a figure of speech, but he said, if one of us has to get drunk, if one of us has to drink again, I hope it's me instead of you. Now, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that marvelous? Isn't that dumb? Yes, fellow alcoholics, if you don't figure it out, that is dumb. Now, the good news is that none of us ever...